Today we celebrate our 6th birthday on the air. Our first show was February 18th, 2009. And I remember how nervous I was during that first show. Happy birthday! Well, over the last 6 years, I've had the pleasure and honor to talk with some really brilliant, wonderful people in the dog world. And today I'm airing some of my favorite segments of conversation over the years. So enjoy these brilliant interviews with people like Patricia McConnell, Dr. Michael Fox, Mark Beckoff, Maggie McClure, and Alexander Horowitz. Today is also my wife's birthday, Darcy, and also my dachshund's birthday. I know. 3 special birthdays to celebrate today. Happy birthday to Darcy and Leia. I love you both very much. I want to say a special thank you to my booth engineer and, is it director of operations now? Is that the right title?
Operations manager.
Operations manager, Eric.
Thank you.
Yeah. I've so enjoyed working with you over the last 6 years, and I appreciate everything you do to help me make the dog show with Julie Forbes the successful program it is.
Well, likewise.
Yeah, 6 years. Pretty sweet. So, 2 quick announcements before I run this best of compilation. March 7th and 8th, the Seattle Kennel Club Dog Show at CenturyLink Field Event Center. Saturday and Sunday, all day, both days. Be sure to stop by our booth and grab some free snacks. And, of course, a dog show with Julie Forbes car sticker. Also, say hi to Pure Air Odor Eliminator. They'll have a booth there as well. March 7th and 8th at CenturyLink Field Event Center, the Seattle Kennel Club Dog Show. You can go to www.seattlekennelclub.org for more information. And I'm excited on our 6th birthday to make one of the biggest announcements for the show that I've had. March 4th, Wednesday, on that show, I am so excited to be talking with Dr. Temple Grandin. Dr. Temple Grandin is the author of Animals in Translation, Using the Mysteries of Autism to Decode Animal Behavior. She's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, best-selling author, autistic activist, and consultant to the livestock industry on animal behavior. Actually, really, she's transformed the livestock industry with her work. She's incredible. Wednesday, March 4th, I'll be talking with Dr. Temple Grandin on The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. You do not want to miss this episode. So excited. So enjoy today this best of compilation as we celebrate 6 years on the air. And we'll be back next Wednesday live from 2 to 3 p.m. Thanks for listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. What I've done for today's show is we're doing really for the first time, and I really loved doing this, and I actually think that I'll want to do it again because there's so much content to go through, but I put together a best of for today. So I selected 6 segments of varying times. From some, most of them, let's see, 5 of them were interviews. And then the one that I chose was, the show that I did, which was a week and a half after my dog died. An important, show, just me reflecting on, you know, or sharing what I'm going through. And then we had some listeners calling in actually on that show. That was dog show number 31. And here we are at 300.
Going all the way back to 2009.
I know.
If you can believe it.
I know it. So I'm going to start off with one of my, this was another early one, number 37, Dr. Michael Fox, which, and this is a show that I have replayed during weeks that I've wanted to choose a favorite interview. I've replayed it in its entirety. It's that good. But the part that I specifically picked out was the part that Dr. Fox is talking about prescription diets for dogs and really talking about the Institution of Veterinary Medicine. So we're going to play Dr. Fox's interview, and then we'll be back in just a few minutes, and I'll introduce the next one. So enjoy this compilation of best ofs of The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. And here's my interview with Dr. Michael Fox back in 2009.
But when you go into your local vet hospital, especially these franchise ones, they call them McVeterinary Hospitals.
Yeah.
The first thing you see is the topical flea spot that you've got to put on, or the flea pill,
yeah,
which is another bugger for jamming the immune system and causing neurological and other problems.
Yeah.
Then you see this whole aisle is like being in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
Of all these bags and cans
mm-hmm.
are the regular cat and dog foods,
mm-hmm.
which the first ingredients are generally chicken meal, whatever that is, and then corn and soy byproducts and so on, which is food that is not fit for a dog or a cat. And then on the other side, you see all the very expensive science-based prescription diets,
yeah.
which are very expensive
mm-hmm.
and are given when these animals get sick on their regular food.
Right.
And as you've pointed out before, a lot of these special prescription diets contain the same ingredients that the animals have been eating before and are responsible for their nutrition-related health problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a big money wheel. Now, these vets get brainwashed at vet college.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrition should be one of the major courses in vet school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. Nutrition is the cornerstone in medicine. Hippocrates said, make your food your medicine and your medicine your food.
Mm-hmm.
But that paradigm, that worldview is not there.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they're given a short course essentially telling them that manufactured pet foods are science-based and they provide complete balanced nutrition for the animal's entire lives,
mm-hmm.
which is a complete myth that our book helps to dispel.
Mm-hmm.
There are tremendous genetic differences in dogs as to their requirements. For example, the Wheaton Terrier, no pun intended, is allergic to wheat, and they will have seizures on wheat, and a lot of other dogs will.
Mm-hmm.
Some are so sensitive to annatto, which is a color dye, a normal vegetable color dye from a lipstick tree, and that's in yellow and orange cheese. One little piece, and a sensitive dog will have a seizure.
Mm.
And, you know, epilepsy is not mentioned in the pet health insurance report. But that, from my column, is one of the major issues. That these poor dogs finish up on phenobarb or potassium bromide, even though they become zombies for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
One, in fact, a change in diet, like my homemade recipe that's on my website,
mm-hmm.
would cure them overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely appalling. I'm completely stunned by the whole nonsense.
Yeah. What is your website?
It's www.2bitdog, TWOBITDOG, 2bitdog.com/Dr. Fox, DRFOX.
And that was a great clip from all the way back in 2009.
It sure was.
Yeah.
Dr. Michael Fox.
Friend of the show.
Yes, one of my favorite guests. Well, he's been on a few times over the years, so you can search for him in the archives. Which are all on dogradioshow.com and also on iTunes. So this next clip is from 2009 in September when my first dog as an adult passed away. I had to euthanize Chewy, my boy, my first boy. And it was a week and a half after he died. And it was the first time that I've had gone through this with my own dog. I had lost, you know, family dogs as a child, but it's different. And I spent the whole show just talking about what, you know, my experience and what, you know, the making the decision to put him down and how hard that was. And I'm kind of going through some details about that. And then we had some listeners actually call into that show and share, which was really wonderful to hear from people who had been there. And, you know, we know how hard it is, and it's not validated as much in society as when we lose a human family member, but people who know and a lot of people who would listen to this show know how brutal it is to lose a loved pet. So you can hear the grief in my voice in this one for sure, but it really brings up some important information, I think, around end-of-life experiences with pets and, you know, best equip everybody to, you know, go through that process as smoothly as possible. So this is from Dog Show number 31 back in 2009.
And it is something that is certainly part of the deal of living with a dog or living with a pet, that we often have to make that decision that we probably wouldn't have to make if dogs lived in nature. Somebody told me, something that we forget is that because we bring animals into our houses and live with them in our houses, that we then end up having to often be the ones to have to make that choice of, okay, you know, is it time now to end their life? Because if they lived outside in nature, they probably would have been gone much sooner. And it just, you know, nature takes its course, and they wouldn't have survived as long as they do living in our houses with us, with the, you know, vet care that we have access to and stuff like that. So, you know, it's hard. It was a really hard part for me of the whole experience, you know, my discomfort with having to make the decision, okay, go ahead and end his life, when it's the last thing that I wanted to do, but I felt like it was the only thing that I could do to protect him from suffering. I didn't want to just wait for him to crash and to have to put him down in crisis. I didn't want him to suffer. I didn't want him to die on his own, you know, in a way that was really uncomfortable or scary for him. And, you know, surgery wasn't really a viable option either. I certainly explored that. But with a 12-year-old dog, and just the odds that, you know, this was caused by tumors, very, very likely cancerous tumor, very, very likely that it was an aggressive type of cancer that had spread. You know, it was like, okay, well, there's maybe a, you know, miraculous chance that he would survive. But the risk was that, you know, I go in, put him through surgery, they go in there and open him up and just find tumors everywhere and then have to put him down on the table. And that it was really important for me to be holding him when he left. It was just so important for me, you know, that I got to control his last day, to have, you know, for him to be happy when he went, and to be in my arms seemed like the best thing that I could do for him. But man, it's not easy. That's probably the hardest thing that I've had to go through. One of the hardest things for sure. We have Heather in Seattle on line one. Hi, Heather.
Hi, I just tuned in, so I didn't get to hear a lot of about what you were talking about, but I understand your experience. You just went through having to put your dog to sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've had to do it before, and I'm in a position now where I have a very, very old dog.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult because I, too, want to have some control over how it happens, and I struggle every day almost with, do I do it sooner than later, so she's at home and comfortable.
Yeah.
Or do I just kind of let things take its course? But I'm also terrified. I don't want to end up in a emergency situation where it's chaotic and stressful and she's at the vet and that sort of thing. So
yeah.
I don't know what your experience was, but I know how hard it is. I mean, even the last two dogs I've had to put to sleep were older, but they were ill. And it was very obvious.
Yeah.
And with my dog, it's like she's just old. She's just really old. She's 16, and she's hanging in there. She loves her walks and loves eating still, but it's the hardest thing. And I'm sorry. I know how hard it is. So
yeah.
But I don't know. All I can say is I'm sure every dog owner out there has to go through it, just like you said, and it's so difficult to have to make that choice for another living thing. It's really excruciating.
Yeah, it really is, and there's no real easy way around it. It's like damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah, and, you know, people have different philosophies. I know people that have let their animals just go and let them go and go and go and die on their own, and I've seen that with other people's pets, and that makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I know how hard it is for people to let go. So
yeah.
I'm sure you did the right thing, and that's, you just have to know you do the right thing by your animal. I mean, they know that. So. Yeah.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call. We're going to send you back to Darcy to get your information. But thanks for sharing your story and for letting me know that you know how I feel.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, okay. Heather.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah. You know, something that I was clear about, and it's a really good point that she makes and that I wanted to clarify for people, because sometimes it is more clear than others. You know, the dog might just get obviously sick and they're obviously having a hard time. And sometimes dogs just sort of fade out slowly and it seems like they're still, you know, doing okay, but at the same time, not. And that it's basically, you know, in making my decision, you can only do the best that you can. But what I was really clear about was that it wasn't about me, that this decision was all about him. And so trying to make my decision based off of his best interest and just being really clear about that and not letting my own needs get in the way when he needs me the most, which was really in his exit.
Boy, listening back to that interview, when I listened to it in its entirety when I was selecting a segment, and it really brought me back to the experience, and I felt some emotions come up almost, 5+ years afterwards. So really, really touching to hear that from me and to kind of reconnect me to that experience. And, you know, hopefully if anyone's listening who's in that spot now, hopefully that helps to at least provide some comfort, because a lot of people know what you're going through. So let's take a break. And then when we come back, I will introduce the next segment, which will be my interview with Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, who's the author of a book called Inside of a Dog. Loved talking with her. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may think my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as...
Hey, Dog Show fans. Does something stink in your home or car? Pure Air is a powerful odor eliminator that is the only natural food-grade product in its category. It works on bedding, kennels, litter boxes, urine, vomit, poop, even skunk spray. You know, all the fun smells our pets bring into our home. It's so non-toxic that you can literally eat it, a requirement for our home and our dogs. Spray Pure Air on anything you can put water on and let your nose watch the odor disappear. Ask for Pure Air in stores that specialize in natural, non-toxic products for home. Or visit dogradioshow.com for a link to their website. I'm Julie Forbes, your host of The Dog Show. Pure Air is the only odor eliminator you'll find in my home. You'll love it.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, February 22nd, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. We'll replay our last Vet Sunday with Dr. Bill Burlingame. Dr. Bill's a brilliant veterinarian and always on the leading edge of new developments to help our animal friends. So be sure to tune in for lots of great information on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Berrien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I don't need no cold water to make me realize that I love my dog as much as I love you. But you make a thing, my dog will always come through.
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes on our 300th episode today. Eric has helped me put together a best of show for you, where I've gone through and selected several of my favorite segments out of many. It was really hard to choose. I'll have to do this again. So we're going to keep going. And next I'm going to play a segment from my interview with Alexander Horowitz, who is the author of a book called Inside of a Dog. Really recommend this book. Really, really interesting. She does wonderful work and was really a joy to talk to. So enjoy my interview. This was Dog Show number 226, my interview with Dr. Alexandra Horowitz. You actually spoke to something that I was planning on asking you anyway. You know, I was kind of thinking to myself as I'm reading your book and getting some insight into what you know and your experience. And I'm curious, because of the depth of how you've studied and observed and your education and all of that, because you also talk a lot about Pumpernickel and who has since passed, and then Finnegan, who is your current dog. And I'm curious as to what your perspective is, or your reflection or thoughts on if you have thought that your, because of the extent of the research that you've done, is your relationship, how has that impacted your relationship with your own dogs? And how do you imagine it's different from that of the average dog owner?
I think I have a lot more patience with my dogs, actually, than I did before. And maybe than the average dog owner, if maybe I was an average dog owner. I was always interested in and sensitive to animals and concerned about their plight, kind of, and, you know, wanting things to go well for them. And that included my own dogs, but I also left my dog all day while I was at work. And at the time, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about trying to find an outlet for her in the middle of the day, where now a lot of people do. But at the time, it wasn't that occurrence, and I just wasn't in my mind, you know. So there was some leap of thinking, empathizing, kind of, that I hadn't gotten to, that I now really have. And that means that I am very attentive all the time to their, you know, who they're with, what they want to do, what I'm providing for them, if something is troubling for them. And I don't think it's obsessive at all. It's very easy, just the way you're thinking about another animate thing and you're in the room with you, you know, who provides a lot of, like a great relationship for you. And I also have changed my walks a lot with them. When I lived with Pumpernickel, we really started doing these smell walks, as I described in the book, where she was getting on in years, and so she didn't really want to have as long a walk to begin with. But my idea of the walk was still, you go out to get a little exercise or to allow her to relieve herself, et cetera. And then it changed to just follow her nose, basically, and stop when she wanted to stop and dig her nose into something for 5 minutes. Just stop there.
Because they will. They will stop for five minutes and just smell and smell and smell. Yeah.
Right. And with my own dog, with my dogs now, we have two dogs now. We'll do that too. Not every walk is an exercise walk or just about peeing. It's also to let them smell what's going on outside. This, like, this exciting olfactory universe that they're closed away from. Some good chunk of the day. And so in every way, I'm just really interested in kind of maximizing the situation for them. And it has almost nothing to do with, like, products for dogs and, you know, and things that humans think are interesting. It's really all from the dog's perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's been great. So I think that people, you know, come to that at different levels. But a lot of people are not really aware of that at all, because there's a very exhaustive kind of industry and worldview of looking at the dog as something which has to be trained and just potty trained and to sit, and then that's kind of it. Then they could be left alone. They should be able to, like, fit in the family.
Right. They'll be happy.
Our dogs are always happy. They're, you know, and that's kind of consumed our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have gotten away from that, certainly, you know, but, I'm on the far end of that, you know, and I'm sure I have a ways to go. I have met many more things to learn, and my relationships will change with them still, I'm sure of it.
Well, it is something that I talk about. I've talked on the show about plenty of times in the past and on a regular basis with my clients, because what I'm doing is teaching them how to communicate with their dogs. They have expectations. Oftentimes I'm working with challenging behaviors and, you know, understanding, well, why is the dog doing it, first of all, and then talking about a solution. But I'd say one of the biggest things and most common things is that people just are not present. I mean, in general, let alone to their dog, because things are so, I mean, everybody, especially in Seattle, is glued to their phone, and you can do five things at once from your phone, and everything is faster, faster, faster. And when you're training or working with a dog or trying to modify a behavior, you got to slow down and just get present. And that alone is a huge shift for people. Like, oh.
I agree. It's an illusion that dogs are just simple, right?
Yeah.
That we forget literally that they're animate and that they have constant needs and demands. And the way you talk about, you know, a challenging behavior is just right as far as I'm concerned, because people just view dogs as misbehaving all the time, as though they should have an instant, immediate understanding of what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do. And the whole notion that a dog, on coming into a human household, sort of has this, like, you know, super ego, which describes to them the right and wrong, the rules. It's incredible.
I know.
That we would do that. And then so we view all their behavior in that light. But that's such a misguided way to start or continue to have a relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, you can. You can have a whole lifelong relationship with a dog like that. And many have. But mm-hmm. I think it's so much better to not use misbehavior, for instance. And as you say, slow down and look at their dog and see what's happening that causes the behavior. And sometimes just that can change it.
Yeah, for sure. So I saw Dr. Alexander Horowitz, as well as Dr. Michael Fox, who was the first segment, and also Mark Beckoff and Patricia McConnell, who will be coming up in the Sparks conference, one of two Sparks conferences, the Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science. So that has been a source of a lot of really awesome content. So next up is Mark Beckoff, who's the author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. And he and I had a really interesting conversation about how animals experience emotions. You know, we, of course, specifically talked about dogs, but really wonderful book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, with Dr. Mark Beckoff. So enjoy my talk with him. So you mentioned the word anthropomorphism, which flies around all over the place, more so in the past, in the field of, you know, my field, dog training and behavior, but I think in animals, working with animals in general. And it means to attribute human characteristics to non-human animals. And it's, like you've said, it's actually becoming more, it's not shunned the way that it was always said, don't anthropomorphize. And now it's like, well, there's actually quite a bit of value in relating to an animal and sort of describing or almost translating, as long as you're maintaining the animal's point of view and clearly not projecting your own emotions onto the animal. So that's where the distinction is.
Right.
For me.
Right. I mean, anthropomorphism is basically the attribution of human characteristics or traits to non-human entities. And, you know, another example would be people talk about angry thunderstorms or angry tornadoes. I mean, the deal for me with anthropomorphism, I call it one of the A words, is that it's been used, or the critics have been duplicitous about it, because an example that I've written about, and there's others, is if I say, for example, that an elephant in a zoo isn't happy, the critic will say, oh, you're being anthropomorphic. She is happy. And then it gets really quiet. And the reason it gets quiet is simply because to say that an animal is happy is to be anthropomorphic. And so my take on it is that, once again, if you ascribe to solid biological and evolutionary theory, especially, once again, Charles Darwin's ideas on continuity, then when we talk about a dog being happy or a dog grieving. We're not inserting something human into them.
Mm-hmm.
We're discussing their own emotional lives. And once again, you know, people have written volumes about anthropomorphism, but the fact of the matter is we have no alternatives, and I put forth an idea that we need to be biocentrically anthropomorphic, and what that $10 phrase really means is that we need to take into account the lives of the animals. So the question isn't, do dogs feel emotions? It's why do they feel emotions? Do killer whales, polar bears, elephants, chimpanzees, and other animals feel emotions? The question is really, why have emotions evolved?
Would you say it's accurate to say that the term anthropomorphism is coming from the assumption that humans are the only animals that actually experience emotions in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, historically, you know, that's basically how it was, you know, used. It was, but yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, and I think that's a really good way to think about it, is that we're attributing something human to non-human animals, and they really don't have it.
Yeah, and I think it does so, acknowledging that animals do experience emotion. It also, too, I mean, I hear people all the time sort of misdiagnose their dog's behavior and say, oh, well, you know, she's doing this to get back at me, or, you know, sort of, it's like, well, no, I can see how it would feel that way to you, but actually an understanding from the dog's perspective, these are actually the reasons why this behavior, you know, why the dog is expressing this behavior. So I think it does happen. It's not like, oh, it's just a free for all now and we can start, you know, relating to our dogs as if they're people, but really knowing where that line is.
Right. I mean, yeah, I mean, we can be, you know, some people say, well, look, you know, so-and-so was wrong about this, or you were wrong about this. And, you know, there's a number of, you know, comebacks. One is, just because you're wrong some of the time doesn't mean you're wrong all the time. But people also misread the literature. So here's a really good example that centers on dogs. Alexandra Horowitz, who will be at the meeting in mm-hmm. Seattle,
yeah.
did a study, and she discovered that humans were not very good at reading guilt in dogs. Okay, they would think the dogs were behaving guilty when in fact they weren't, or they would say, oh, the dog is behaving guilty because they did something and they didn't. But Alex did not say that dogs can't feel guilt. She just said we're not good at reading it. And that is a huge difference in, you know, conclusion.
Mm.
And so, I mean, Alex is a good friend of mine, and I've talked to her a lot about it, and I wrote an article for Psychology Today about it because a very popular book came out a couple of months ago and basically said that Alex Horowitz discovered that dogs don't feel guilt. So I'm not sort of beating it to death. I'm basically saying that, yeah, you have to be careful. But I would have to say that, you know, the vast majority of the time when you watch two dogs play, they're enjoying themselves. And when it gets to the point where they're not, one dog may break it off or refuse the play solicitation from another dog.
Yeah.
But I think it just is absolutely stupid to say that we don't know whether the dogs are enjoying themselves. And once again, we've got the same thing with tickling and joy in rats. I mean,
yeah.
These studies were highly invasive, and they're not the kind of studies that I support, but they were done. So if we look at the results, once again published in really highly prized peer-reviewed professional journals, we see that rats are mammals.
Mm-hmm.
They have the same neural architecture that we have for emotions. So once again, I think it's just robbing animals of their emotions and pondering, you know, whether they feel this or that, it's just a waste of time. I really, really mean it. Once again, the question is why would joy evolve? Why would grief evolve? Why would jealousy, resentment, embarrassment, and empathy evolve, not if they have evolved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. It does seem to be that there's, personally, I've heard of some studies that have been done, and it's like, why do you have to study this to know that it's true. It's like you're studying what's obvious to pretty much everybody, I think, who's out there. We just proved it, you know.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm a scientist and I love science, mm-hmm. but, you know, I always say it's not the only show in town, but mm-hmm. I think you can't just look and, you know, pick certain things like you pick potato chips out of a bag because they support your theory. I mean, the research done on empathy in mice that was published about 7 years ago was horrifically abusive.
Yeah.
It was done by neuroscientists at McGill University and published in Science magazine. Well, people could say, well, you know, we knew mice display empathy. Well, we didn't quote know it in the scientific sense, but now we do. And same, like I said, with rats and pigs and, you know, many other animals. So we don't need to study it anymore. And the fact is, now that we know that they display empathy and now that we know their sentient, then they feel pain, this should really be driving us to radically changing and improving our standards of conduct for research.
Love talking with Mark Beckoff. Such a great guy, great ideas. And I just love the voice that he's bringing to this topic about animals and emotions. Really important that so a lot of people still think that animals don't feel emotions, and they indeed do. So I chose this next one. I've had some really wonderful conversations with Maggie McClure over the years. I've had her on the show a number of times in promotion of the Vashon Sheepdog Classic, which is one of my favorite events every year in the Seattle area. So I talk with Maggie about herding breeds and that world, because the Vashon Sheepdog Classic is a sheepdog trial. So it's mostly border collies herding sheep. And you get to go and sit on the side of a beautiful farm and watch these dogs do what they were designed to do. And there's a lot there to talk about. So this is a little bit of my conversation with Maggie McClure. But you can, of course, find her interviews and all of these archived in their entirety at dogradioshow.com. And you can also fetch them at iTunes as a free audio podcast. So enjoy my talk with Maggie McClure next of Vashon Sheepdog Classic. So, Maggie, I have a question that I've sent some of my clients to you for herding lessons and then just in general talking about their herding breeds. And one of the questions that they ask me frequently is, but if I take my will taking my dog herding amplify their herding drive, and so would it therefore be like, would they start wanting to herd everything, like, you know, the vacuum if they don't already?
Right.
Have you had any I know you've had experience with it, but any thoughts on that?
My thought is that the dogs are pretty conceptual, so I do believe that if you have a dog who wants to, say, herd your children or something inappropriately, taking them to stalk and having them learn about thinking and hearing you when they're in a high drive kind of mindset, it's only going to help you have more control over your dog, because we can just say, oh, you know, time to stop. You need to come away from the sheep now, or now you can, so we can control their access mm-hmm. To the stock, which is hard to do with the local squirrel at the park. So, you know, you can help have your dog starting to think and hear you when they're in a amped up spot. So
yeah.
That's helpful. I don't think it increases their need to go, you know, have that feeling in other places. I think it becomes very situational.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seemed like that's been my sort of sense for it as well.
Your dogs didn't start herding flies until after you took them to sheep?
Well, they have the drive. I mean, you know, they've just got it. I've noticed Levi get more intense about the fly situation because he wants to work, and so it's just self-reinforced. So now he's like, oh, you know, and we do live in the city, and we don't have
the space that they really should have, that they really are meant to be in. I mean, when we take them out to, we have a friend who has acreage, like 150 acres out in northeastern Washington. And I've talked about, when I go out there, I've talked about how amazing it is to go out there and how different the cattle dogs are when they're outside off leash for long days, you know.
Yeah.
Changes
it completely, doesn't it?
Oh,
their
totally.
Energy just relaxes.
Totally. And
it's totally cool.
And
yeah.
It's not just that they're like not not so amped or like frenetic or challenging, but actually they really are amazing. They are incredible dogs to have out in that because they don't wander around. Like, they really know how to handle themselves out there also, as opposed to like my dachshund, whose nose, you know, of course, is going to take her out to hunt the ground squirrels, and she'll end up getting snatched up by a coyote if I'm not, you know, on her about it and making her stay closer to where we are. And they just are amazing. It's actually really impressive to see them handle themselves out there, and it's quite the contrast to living in the city. So
yeah, it's like a little homecoming for
it's
dogs.
Amazing.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's cool.
Yeah. So that's cool, and it does seem like what you said, like, okay, well, the drive is there, so why not teach the dog and the owner how to handle themselves when they are connected to that, the intensity of their drive, how they, you know, teach them to keep their brains engaged and be able to listen even when they are tapped into that purest form of the drive. So,
and
it's just really cool, I think, for people to experience that as well. I mean, it's pretty ancestral for us too. All right. Wonderful interview with Maggie McClure. Love talking with her. VashonSheepdogClassic.com is their website. And we're going to take a quick break and then come back with, maybe if I had to choose, my favorite of all time, Patricia McConnell, my talk with her. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
I never felt so free. It was just my dog and me.
Pure Air's powerful formula lets you eliminate pet odors safely. It's strong enough to effectively get rid of smells like urine, plus stronger odors like those that can be caused by illness. Pure Air is safe enough to spray directly onto people, animals, or use in the bath or laundry. Pure Air is perfect for dealing with dire situations, refreshing your dog between baths, or just before company comes. Pure Air is the most effective product you can buy to remove stinky pet odors safely. Find it at stores like Mud Bay, McClendon's, and Natural Pet Pantry, or visit their website, pureair.com. That's pure, A-Y-R-E.com. I'm Julie Forbes, host of The Dog Show. Pure Air is the only odor eliminator you'll find in my home. You'll love it.
Wish your dog didn't hate going to the vet? Wish you were welcomed by a team who cared? Jet City Animal Clinic is an enjoyable respite from the same old thing. Dr. Anderson and her team have created a full-service facility that combines veterinary expertise with a comfortable style. Jet City Animal Clinic is located in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood on 12th Avenue across from Seattle U. Bring your crazy questions, odd ideas, and alternative thinking. Jet City Animal Clinic will work with you to keep your furry family members healthy and happy. Traditionally educated with an open mind, call us at 206-329-0253 or email info@jetcityanimalclinic.com to make an appointment. Jet City Animal Clinic, a unique approach to the health care of your urban pet, a local family practice. JetCityAnimalClinic.com.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
These dreams for free. That's just my dog and me.
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, celebrating our 300th episode today. Just want to, before I run out of time, want to say such a big thank you to Eric for all of your help over the many years. You do such a great job, Eric.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so Patricia McConnell is up next, one of my all-time favorites for sure. Be sure to look up this interview in its entirety. This was Dog Show number 276. Enjoy. Getting right back into our conversation about dominance, and you had said on break that you wanted to get into, and I do too, what role or not does dominance play in dog training?
I would argue none.
Okay.
I would argue virtually none for a variety of reasons. One, I don't really want to think about trying to raise my tail base. We can't communicate with dogs the way we would like to sometimes. So that's number one, you know, and I think a lot of what people think of as, quote, being dominant is just completely confusing to dogs because it has nothing to do with the way they sort of work out their social hierarchy between the two. The other thing, just very quickly, I just should say parenthetically, I think dogs vary tremendously in how relevant it is to them.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Absolutely.
Some dogs, they couldn't care less. It's like, whatever, take the bone. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it also varies about, I don't like that bone, but I want to do this, you know, a lot. So it's highly variable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something well understood in field ethology as well. As even being territorial is actually highly variable depending on the resource. So that said, I think it has no relevance in dog training. The third reason I think it has no relevance is that the best way to get a dog to do what we want, first of all, is to teach it that it's fun to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we should be focusing on. That's most effective. It doesn't get all about do it because, you know, dominance one is not about control. It has nothing to do with control. And we're just muddying the waters, you know? It's really, if you want your dog to come when called, first of all, it has nothing to do with dominance or social order. Two, the best way to do it without question, and we know this from decades and decades and decades of research, is to use positive reinforcement and to teach a dog that it's really fun to come when you call. Can you stop every dog from chasing a deer if it's 50 yards in front of you? No.
Mm-hmm.
No. You know, there are breed issues, there are individual issues, there are when you got your dog issues. You know, for example, did you get it as a puppy?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so fun and so wonderful to discover this whole new world of putting yourself in your dog's place and imagining, well, what does she want right now? What does he want right now? What can I do to help him do what I want and reinforce him for it in a way that he'll do it again? And how do I start in a situation in which she is able to do what I ask? I think that's one of the biggest pitfalls, don't you think, Julie, is that people ask dogs to come when called or sit and stay when they haven't had the experience and the training to be that good at something that hard at that level of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like expecting a 5-year-old kid to play Beethoven's, I don't know, fifth,
right,
to 4,000 people when they've just sort of learned to play, you know, some Silent Night on the piano,
right,
with their fingers or,
right,
something. You know, so it's just sad to me that so many people are still being sold a bill of goods that dogs should do what you want them to do because they respect you. And then usually the ways to get them to do that is using force, which is a way to lose respect.
Yeah. So then, I totally agree with you. I think in the place to start, and I say this to people all the time, the best way to get a dog to do something for you is for them to want to do it in the first place.
Perfect.
So to, create the experience so that the dog is like, you know, awesome. I had a woman tell me once, she had a 10-month-old husky. So talk about coming when called, female. And she said, we cannot get her to come to us no matter what. She will not come to us no matter what. We have to say beef jerky. Every time we say beef jerky, she comes no matter what. I said, well, what does she think of when you say beef jerky? Beef jerky.
Story.
She's like, sign me up. I'll come every time.
Just say beef jerky.
Yeah. But sometimes the dogs won't choose, you know, as much as you do that. And this is, I think it's so important because there's not one answer to this question. As you could do everything right from puppyhood and have a dog that isn't easy and, you know, has an agenda of their own.
Yes.
And you do thousands of repetitions with the highest value reward that you can think of, and you build up distraction in the way that's appropriate and all that stuff. And then you still have, whether it be because of a drive or just a choice, that they just don't do it. And then it's a question of, well, what do we do next? And I think that's where, because the fear is that the conversation then is going to be about being, you know, mean, bad, ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case either. And, you know, boundaries are important and follow through is important. And a lot of times you can just establish that by just ending up getting it. But, you know, and you talked about boundaries, and one of your books, you talked about, you know, having this conversation, like you can love your dog without spoiling your dog.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also establish yourself as a leader and not be forceful. So have we covered everything you wanted to say as far as dominance and its role? You say dominance has no role in dog training. And I kind of want to say also, like, well, you know, kind of living, there's a difference between dog training and also just living with a dog.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. There's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that word leader, because that word too has become extremely controversial.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like it. I use it less and less just because so many people respond negatively to it, but it's really all about how you perceive it. You know, another way to use that term is a teacher. You know, I do think dogs, and especially a certain type of personality, they really need to feel like they're not sort of lost in a sea,
mm-hmm.
where they have no idea, where every choice they make, they have no guidance on. I really strongly believe that there are some dogs that need help. They need guidance. You mm-hmm. know, they need teachers. They need mentors. They need us to help them sort through the world.
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean by leader. And I know some people, they don't like that word because they think of it again, as they think of, like, you know, dominance, the alpha, and roll your dog over. I don't mean it that way. I mean it in the sense of being there as a teacher or a guide for your dog. Because I think, you know, some dogs don't need that, but I guess this brings up one of the points I think is so important that you indirectly alluded to, which is that every dog is different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just because you have a golden retriever doesn't mean it's going to love all your visitors. And just because you have a border collie doesn't mean it's brilliant or easy to train. Actually, some of them are harder to train than a lot of dogs. So I think one of the things that's really important is to think of dogs as individuals. I mean, I have three dogs right now, two border collies and a cavalier. I would never take the cavalier off leash to a big open woods area and just let her go.
Yeah.
And I would never do that. One, she was in a puppy mill for 7 years. Mm. I didn't get her show until she was 7 and a half.
Wow.
Two, she's a Cavalier Spaniel.
Yeah.
And she, I mean, I say come, you know, at home, and she'll often just sort of whip around and run at me like, you know, a dog from a movie. But I have to give her much higher reinforcement ratio than I do the border collies. Anyway, so I think, you know, say you have a dog who you've done, quote, done everything. You've worked with the best trainers in the world. You've used every reinforcement. You've gone step by step. And you have a dog who you just can't trust in a certain context outside off leash. You know what? That's okay. Then you have a dog you just can't trust.
Right.
And you need to manage it. And I think that's one of the biggest differences between professional trainers and the general dog-loving public, is that the trainers accept that a lot of having a happy dog is mm-hmm. management.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with putting your crazy, exuberant 6-month-old dog in a back room
mm-hmm.
with a chew toy when you open the door. you know, to visitors until you get that turned around.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, there's nothing wrong with management. We manage our kids all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We help them stay out of trouble. There's nothing wrong with that.
I think it's a great point, and I'm really glad that you said this, because a lot of times I have to tell people, that's not your dog. You know, they see the lab who sits out in the front lawn and would just never leave for anything, no matter what walks by,
right.
And they're not,
right.
And they want that dog. And it's like, you're not, this is not that dog and never will be, ever.
And they have a pointer. You know?
Right. And I think it's important to have a reasonable and appropriate expectation for the, you know, every dog as an individual. Just for them to be the best version of themselves that they can be.
Oh, I think that's so true. And you know, adding on to that, I think so many people feel guilty.
Yeah.
Because their dog isn't that fancy, stereotypical, lassy, rin-tin-tin dog.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, there are very few of those. Few of those. And almost none of them, because there's always something. You know, Lassie probably peed in the kitchen and we didn't know it because June cleaned it up.
That's right.
Or, you know.
They edited that part out.
Yeah. Right.
Such an awesome interview with Patricia McConnell. Again, look it up in its entirety, as well as all of our 300 episodes on dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. So grateful in the spirit of Thanksgiving for the opportunity to be here with you all every week, live Wednesdays, 2 to 3 p.m. Thanks for listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.